This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident, and The Illusion of Safety by Eric Schlosser. Read by Scott Brick. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Leonard Cohen. For My Father. Part 1. The Titan. Not good. On September 18, 1980, at about 6:30 in the evening, Senior Airman David F. Powell and Airman Jeffrey L. Plum walked into the silo at Launch Complex 3747, a few miles north of Damascus, Arkansas. They were planning to do a routine maintenance procedure on a Titan II missile. They'd spent countless hours underground at complexes like this one, but no matter how many times they entered the silo, the Titan II always looked impressive. It was the largest intercontinental ballistic missile ever built by the United States, 10 feet in diameter and 103 feet tall, roughly the height of a 9-story building. It had an aluminum skin with a matte finish and U.S. Air Force painted in big letters down the side. The nose cone on top of the Titan II was deep black, and inside it sat a W-53 thermonuclear warhead, the most powerful weapon ever carried by an American missile. The warhead had a yield of 9 megatons, about 3 times the explosive force of all the bombs dropped during the Second World War, including both atomic bombs. Day or night, winter or spring, the silo always felt the same. It was eerily quiet, and mercury vapor lights on the walls bathed the missile in a bright white glow. When you opened the door on a lower level and stepped into the launch duct, the Titan II loomed above you like an immense black-tipped silver bullet, loaded in a concrete gun barrel, primed, cocked, ready to go, and pointed at the sky. The missile was designed to launch within a minute and hit a target as far as 6,000 miles away. In order to do that, the Titan II relied upon a pair of liquid propellants, a rocket fuel and an oxidizer, that were hypergolic. The moment they came into contact with each other, they'd instantly and forcefully ignite. The missile had 2 stages, and inside both of them, an oxidizer tank rested on top of a fuel tank, with pipes leading down to an engine. Stage 1, which extended about 70 feet upward from the bottom of the missile, contained about 85,000 pounds of fuel and 163,000 pounds of oxidizer. Stage 2, the upper section where the warhead sat, was smaller and held about 1/4 of those amounts. If the missile were launched, fuel and oxidizer would flow through the Stage 1 pipes, mix inside the combustion chambers of the engine, catch on fire, emit hot gases, and send almost 500,000 pounds of thrust through the supersonic convergent-divergent nozzles beneath it. Within a few minutes, the Titan II would be 50 miles off the ground. The 2 propellants were extremely efficient and extremely dangerous. The fuel, aerosene 50, could spontaneously ignite when it came into contact with everyday things like wool, rags, or rust. As a liquid, aerosene 50 was clear and colorless. As a vapor, it reacted with the water and the oxygen in the air and became a whitish cloud with a fishy smell. This fuel vapor could be explosive in proportions as low as 2%. Inhaling it could cause breathing difficulties, a reduced heart rate, vomiting, convulsions, tremors, and death. The fuel was also highly carcinogenic and easily absorbed through the skin. The missile's oxidizer, nitrogen tetroxide, was even more hazardous. Under federal law, it was classified as a poison A, the most deadly category of man-made chemicals. In its liquid form, the oxidizer was a translucent yellowy brown. Although not as flammable as the fuel, it could spontaneously ignite if it touched leather, paper, cloth, or wood. And its boiling point was only 70 degrees Fahrenheit. At temperatures any higher, the liquid oxidizer boiled into a reddish-brown vapor that smelled like ammonia. Contact with water turned the vapor into a corrosive acid that could react with the moisture in a person's eyes or skin and cause severe burns. When inhaled, the oxidizer could destroy tissue in the upper respiratory system and the lungs. The damage might not be felt immediately. 6 to 12 hours after being inhaled, the stuff could suddenly cause headaches, dizziness, difficulty breathing, pneumonia, and pulmonary edema, leading to death. Powell and Plum were missile repairmen. They belonged to Propellant Transfer System, PTS, Team A of the 308th Strategic Missile Wing, whose headquarters was about an hour or so away at Little Rock Air Force Base. They'd been called to the site that day because a warning light had signaled that pressure was low in the Stage 2 oxidizer tank. If the pressure fell too low, the oxidizer wouldn't flow smoothly to the engine. A low light could mean a serious problem, a rupture, a leak. But it was far more likely that a slight change in temperature had lowered the pressure inside the tank. Air conditioning units in the silo were supposed to keep the missile cooled to about 60 degrees. If Powell and Plum didn't find any leaks, they'd simply unscrew the cap on the oxidizer tank and add more nitrogen gas. The nitrogen maintained a steady pressure on the liquid inside, pushing downward. It was a simple, mundane task, like putting air in your tires before a long drive. Powell had served on a PTS team for almost 3 years and knew the hazards of the Titan II. During his first visit to a launch complex, an oxidizer leak created a toxic cloud that shut down operations for 3 days. He was 21 years old, a proud hillbilly from rural Kentucky who loved the job and planned to re-enlist at the end of the year. Plum had been with the 308th for just 9 months. He wasn't qualified to do this sort of missile maintenance or to handle these propellants. Accompanying Powell and watching everything that Powell did was considered Plum's OJT, his on-the-job training. Plum was 19, raised in suburban Detroit. Although an oxidizer low light wasn't unusual, Air Force technical orders required that both men wear Category 1 protective gear when entering the silo to investigate it. Going Category 1 meant getting into a rocket fuel handler's clothing outfit, RFHCO, an airtight, liquid-proof, vapor-proof, fire-resistant combination of gear designed to protect them from the oxidizer and the fuel. The men called it a REFCO. A REFCO looked like a spacesuit from an early 1960s science fiction movie. It had a white detachable bubble helmet with a voice-actuated radio and a transparent plexiglass face screen. The suit was off-white, with a long zipper extending from the top of the left shoulder across the torso to the right knee. You stepped into the REFCO and wore long johns underneath it. The black vinyl gloves and boots weren't attached, so the REFCO had roll-down cuffs at the wrists and the ankles to maintain a tight seal. The suit weighed about 22 pounds. The REFCO backpack weighed an additional 35 and carried about an hour's worth of air. The outfit was heavy and cumbersome. It could be hot, sticky, and uncomfortable, especially when worn outside the air-conditioned silo. But it could also save your life. The Stage 2 oxidizer pressure cap was about two-thirds of the way up the missile. In order to reach it, Powell and Plum had to walk across a retractable steel platform that extended from the silo wall. The tall, hollow cylinder in which the Titan II stood was enclosed by another concrete cylinder with 9 interior levels, housing equipment. Level 1 was near the top of the missile, level 9 about 20 feet beneath the missile. The steelwork platforms folded down from the walls hydraulically. Each one had a stiff rubber edge to prevent the Titan II from getting scratched, while keeping the gap between the platform and the missile as narrow as possible. The airmen entered the launch duct at level 2. Far above their heads was a concrete silo door. It was supposed to protect the missile from the wind and the rain and the effects of a nuclear weapon detonating nearby. The door weighed 740 tons. Far below the men, beneath the Titan II, a concrete flame deflector shaped like a W was installed to guide the hot gases downward at launch, then upward through exhaust vents and out of the silo. The missile stood on a thrust mount, a steel ring at level 7 that weighed about 26,000 pounds. The thrust mount was attached to the walls by large springs so that the Titan II could ride out a nuclear attack, bounce instead of break, and then take off. In addition to the W-53 warhead and a few 100,000 pounds of propellants, many other things in the silo could detonate. Electro-explosive devices were used after ignition to free the missile from the thrust mount, separate Stage 2 from Stage 1, release the nose cone. The missile also housed numerous small rocket engines with flammable solid fuel to adjust the pitch and the roll of the warhead mid-flight. The Titan II launch complex had been carefully designed to minimize the risk of having so many flammables and explosives within it. Fire detectors, fire suppression systems, toxic vapor detectors, and decontamination showers were scattered throughout the 9 levels of the silo. These safety devices were bolstered by strict safety rules. Whenever a PTS team member put on a REFCO, he had to be accompanied by someone else in a REFCO, with 2 other people waiting as backup, ready to put on their suits. Every Category 1 task had to be performed according to a standardized checklist, which the team chief usually read aloud over the radio communications network. There was one way to do everything, and only one way. Technical Order 21M LGM 25C 212 Figure 218 told Powell and Plum exactly what to do as they stood on the platform near the missile. Step 4, the PTS team chief said over the radio. Remove airborne disconnect pressure cap. Roger, Powell replied. Caution. When complying with Step 4, do not exceed 160 foot-pounds of torque. Over-torquing may result in damage to the missile skin. Roger. As Powell used a socket wrench to unscrew the pressure cap, the socket fell off. It struck the platform and bounced. Powell grabbed for it, but missed. Plum watched the 9-pound socket slip through the narrow gap between the platform and the missile, fall about 70 feet, hit the thrust mount, and then ricochet off the Titan II. It seemed to happen in slow motion. A moment later, fuel sprayed from a hole in the missile, like water from a garden hose. Oh, man, Plum thought. This is not good. New Wave. Earlier that day, Second Lieutenant Alan D. Childers had gotten out of bed around 5, showered, put on his uniform, kissed his wife goodbye, grabbed his overnight bag, and headed for the pre-departure briefing at Little Rock Air Force Base. Childers was the deputy commander of a Titan II missile combat crew. At 7 o'clock every morning, the crews about to pull an alert gathered in a large room at the headquarters of the 308th Strategic Missile Wing. The 308th operated 18 Titan II launch complexes in Arkansas, each with a single missile and a 4-man crew. The wing's motto was Non Sibi Sed Alis, not for self, but for others. While senior officers and staff stood in the front of the briefing room, each combat crew sat at its own small table. Childers took a seat with his crew. Captain Michael T. Mazzaro was the commander, a brilliant young officer from Massachusetts, about 5'8", with thinning brown hair. Staff Sergeant Rodney L. Holder was the missile systems analyst technician, the one who made sure the missile was always ready to go. He looked a lot like Childers, tall and thin, with fair hair and glasses. Staff Sergeant Ronald O. Fuller, handsome and baby-faced, from Elmira, New York, was the missile facilities technician. His job focused on the workings of the launch site. Once or twice a week, the four of them began their days at one of these briefings and then spent the next 24 hours together underground, monitoring their missile, supervising maintenance at the site, constantly practicing, training, and awaiting the order to launch. Childers hardly fit the stereotype of a war-mongering Strategic Air Command, SAC officer, eager to nuke the Soviets and bring on Armageddon. For about a year before joining the Air Force, he'd been a late-night radio DJ who played mainly acid rock, spent his days surfing, and had hair down to his shoulders. He wasn't a hippie, but he also wasn't harboring any lifelong ambition to become a spit-and-polish military officer. He'd spent most of his childhood on the Japanese island of Okinawa, where his father was an aircraft maintenance mechanic for the Air Force. The family home was a Quonset hut, a prefabricated steel building dating back to the Second World War. Although the accommodations were far from luxurious, growing up on that island during the 1960s was idyllic. Childers spent a lot of time lying on the beach and scuba diving. At Kadena Air Force Base, the social divide between officers and enlisted men like his father was almost impossible to bridge. The two groups did not mix. But at the local high school, nobody seemed to care about military ranks or racial distinctions. White, black, and Asian kids hung out together, and at various times Childers dated not only the daughter of a major, but also the daughter of a colonel. Most of the students had a mother or a father in the armed services. The Vietnam War wasn't a distant, abstract conflict debated in the classroom. It touched almost every household directly. Childers had two brothers and a sister, and they were all proud of their father. But none of them wanted anything to do with the military. After graduating from high school in 1971, Childers went to the University of Arizona, hoping to become an engineer. He dropped out after a few semesters, returned to Okinawa, and found work as a disc jockey at a radio station on the island. He was 19, the youngest employee at the station, and they gave him the late-night shift. It was a dream job. From midnight until 6 in the morning, Childers played his favorite music: Led Zeppelin, Neil Young, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Creedence Clearwater Revival. GIs would call the station and make requests. He loved dedicating songs on their behalf and reading messages on the air to their families and girlfriends. After work, he'd sleep until noon and then hit the beach. The station in Okinawa went off the air in 1973, and Childers moved to Tampa, Florida, hoping to enroll in radio school. But he didn't have enough money for tuition and, after a few months of looking for work, decided to join the Air Force. He expected to wind up in Vietnam one way or another. Serving at an airbase sounded a lot better than carrying a rifle and fighting in the jungle. When Childers enlisted, he filled out a form requesting an assignment with the Armed Forces Radio and Television Service. He thought the Air Force might provide his training to become a radio announcer. But he filled out the form incorrectly and got assigned to the newspaper at Norton Air Force Base in San Bernardino, California. He enjoyed the job and fell for Diane Brandenburg, a budget analyst who worked down the hall. In 1975, his commander persuaded him to become an officer, which would require a college degree. Through the Airman Scholarship and Commissioning Program, he attended Chaminade College of Honolulu, a good place to study and to surf. Diane was stationed at nearby Hickam Air Force Base, and they were married in 1977. All three of Childers' siblings eventually served in the military. His older brother enlisted in the Army, his sister in the Air Force, his younger brother in the Navy. And all of them wound up with spouses who'd either served in the military or been raised in military families. Childers later realized that they'd been drawn back to a familiar way of life. It offered a good education, a sense of mission, the chance to do something useful, and a strong feeling of comradeship with others who'd chosen to serve. In the hierarchy of Air Force officers, the fighter pilots and bomber pilots each claim to be at the top. Despite their intense rivalry, the pilots agreed on at least one thing. Missileers occupied a rung far below them. Serving in an underground control center lacked the glamour of flying sorties into enemy territory or gaining command of the skies. Childers's poor eyesight disqualified him from becoming an Air Force pilot, and the Missile Corps needed officers. Although he knew nothing about intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs, and even less about what a missile officer did, he signed up for the program before graduating from college. He didn't care about the status or traditional Air Force snobbery. The job sounded interesting, and it offered the opportunity to command. Childers spent 6 months studying Titan II operations at Shepard Air Force Base in Texas and Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. Like all Titan II trainees, he carefully read the Dash 1, the technical manual that explained every aspect of the missile system. He spent hours in simulators, mock-ups of the control center where launch checklists and hazard checklists were practiced again and again. But he never saw a real Titan II missile until he pulled his first alert in Arkansas and stepped into the silo. It felt cold in there, like walking into a refrigerator, and the missile looked really big. If an emergency war order arrived from SAC headquarters, every missile crew officer would face a decision with almost unimaginable consequences. Given the order to launch, Childers would comply without hesitation. He had no desire to commit mass murder. And yet the only thing that prevented the Soviet Union from destroying the United States with nuclear weapons, according to the Cold War theory of deterrence, was the threat of being annihilated as well. Childers had faith in the logic of nuclear deterrence. His willingness to launch the missile ensured that it would never be launched. At Vandenberg, he had learned the general categories and locations of Titan II targets. Some were in the Soviet Union, others in China. But a crew was never told where its missile was aimed. That sort of knowledge might inspire doubt. Like four members of a firing squad whose rifles were loaded with three bullets and one blank, a missile crew was expected to obey the order to fire without bearing personal responsibility for the result. After 6 weeks of training at Little Rock, Childers became the deputy commander of a Titan II site in 1979. The following year, he was promoted, joining Mazzaro, Holder, and Fuller on an instructor crew. Unlike a typical crew that spent months or years pulling alerts at the same launch complex, an instructor crew brought trainees to different sites. On the morning of September 18th, Childers and his crew were planning to bring a student, Second Lieutenant Miguel Serrano, to an overnight alert at Launch Complex 374-5, outside the town of Spring Hill. The crew always liked going to 4-5. It was closer to the base than some of the other complexes, which meant they could get there faster and get home sooner the next day. Pre-departure briefings always started with a roll call. Once it was clear that every launch complex would be fully staffed, the wing's senior officers talked to the 80 or so combat crew members about maintenance issues, new safety guidelines, changes in the emergency war order, and the latest weather report. The weather was a crucial factor in any maintenance work that involved fuel, oxidizer, or the re-entry vehicle. Sometimes the briefings included a slide presentation on intelligence issues and the state of the world. On September 18, 1980, the world was unsettled. The president of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, had announced the previous day that the treaty defining the border between his country and Iran was no longer in effect. Troops from the two nations were already fighting skirmishes in southern Khuzestan. Iran's foreign ministry had condemned the hostile invasion by the Iraqi regime, and a war over the disputed territory seemed imminent. In Tehran, 52 American hostages were still being held captive, almost a year after being seized at the U.S. Embassy there. A failed rescue attempt by the U.S. military during the spring of 1980 had prompted Iran's Revolutionary Guards to remove the hostages from the embassy and scatter them at locations throughout the city. Televised images of Iranian crowds burning American flags and shouting "Death to the Great Satan" had become a nightly routine, and the American government seemed powerless to do anything about it. Meanwhile, relations between the United States and the Soviet Union had reached their lowest point since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. The Soviets had invaded Afghanistan 9 months earlier, deploying more than 100,000 troops in a campaign that many feared was just the first stage of a wider assault on the oil-producing nations of the Middle East. The United States had responded to the invasion by imposing a grain embargo on the Soviet Union and boycotting the recent Summer Olympics in Moscow. Neither of those punishments, however, seemed likely to force a Soviet withdrawal from Kabul. The influence of the United States seemed everywhere in decline. On September 17th, the International Institute for Strategic Studies, a prominent British think tank, issued a report suggesting that the Soviet Union's new and more accurate ICBMs had made America's ICBMs vulnerable to attack. The United States was falling behind not only in nuclear weaponry, the report claimed, but also in planes, tanks, and ground forces. Amid this discouraging international news, the mood of the American people seemed equally downbeat. The economy of the United States was in recession, with high inflation and an unemployment rate of about 8%. Gasoline shortages raised the prospect of rationing and federal limits on automobile use. Watergate, the Vietnam War, and the energy crisis had shaken faith in the ability of government to accomplish anything. The President of the United States, Jimmy Carter, had offered his own harsh critique of the national state of mind. During a speech broadcast by the three major television networks in prime time, the President warned that the United States faced an invisible threat, a crisis in confidence. Old-fashioned American optimism had been replaced by a despairing, self-absorbed worship of consumption. "Piling up material goods," Carter said, "cannot fill the emptiness of lives which have no purpose or meaning." The speech ended on a more practical note, outlining half a dozen steps to support renewable energy and eliminate the dependence on foreign oil. The underlying message, however, was that the nation's most important problems could never be solved by Congress or the President, and Carter urged viewers to assume responsibility for their own fate. "All the legislation in the world," he said, "can't fix what's wrong with America." Many Democrats and Republicans disagreed. They thought that Jimmy Carter was the problem, not some vague existential crisis of the American soul. It was a presidential election year, and Carter had gained the Democratic nomination after a bitter primary fight with Senator Edward M. Kennedy. Despite the victory, Carter's approval ratings plummeted. The Iranian hostage crisis brought more bad news every day, and an official report on the failed rescue attempt, describing how 8 American servicemen died and half a dozen U.S. helicopters full of classified documents were abandoned in the desert, raised doubts about the readiness of the military. Although Carter was a devout Christian, a newly created evangelical group, the Moral Majority, was attacking his support for legalized abortion and a constitutional amendment to guarantee equal rights for women. A midsummer opinion poll found that 77% of the American people disapproved of President Carter's performance in the White House, a higher disapproval rate than that of President Richard Nixon at the height of Watergate. The Republican candidate for president, Ronald Reagan, had a sunnier disposition. "I refuse to accept Carter's defeatist and pessimistic view of America," Reagan said. "The country could not afford 4 more years of weakness, indecision, mediocrity, and incompetence." Reagan called for large tax cuts, smaller government, deregulation, increased defense spending to confront the Soviet threat, and a renewed faith in the American dream. A popular third-party candidate, Congressman John B. Anderson, described himself as a centrist, labeling Reagan a right-wing extremist and Carter a bumbler. Anderson agreed that things had gone fundamentally wrong in the United States. "People feel that the country is coming apart at the seams," he said. The nation's underlying anxiety fueled sales of a best-selling nonfiction book in late September, Crisis Investing: Opportunities and Profits in the Coming Great Depression. A number of best-selling novels also addressed the widespread fears about America's future. The Devil's Alternative by Frederick Forsyth described a Soviet plot to invade Western Europe. The Fifth Horseman by Larry Collins and Dominique LaPierre described a Libyan plot to blackmail the United States with a hydrogen bomb hidden in New York City. The Spike by Arnaud de Borchgrave and Robert Moss told the story of a left-wing American journalist who uncovers Soviet plans for world domination but cannot persuade his liberal editor to publish them. Perhaps the most influential bestseller of the year was The Third World War, August 1985, a novel written by a retired British officer, General Sir John Hackett. It offered a compelling, realistic account of a full-scale war between NATO and the Soviet bloc. After a long series of European tank battles, the British cities of Birmingham and Wolverhampton are incinerated by a Soviet nuclear strike. The Russian city of Minsk is hit by nuclear weapons in retaliation, and the shock of its destruction causes the swift collapse of the Soviet Union. The moral of the story was clear. The United States and its allies needed to increase their military spending. In the last few years before the outbreak of war, the West began to wake up to the danger it faced, Hackett wrote, and in the time available did just enough in repair of its neglected defenses to enable it, by a small margin, to survive. Ronald Reagan later called The Third World War an unusually important book, and it helped to launch a new literary genre, the techno-thriller, in which military heroism was celebrated. The intricate details of weaponry played a central role in the narrative, and Cold War victories were achieved through the proper application of force. On television, The Waltons, a long-running drama about an ordinary family's struggles during the Great Depression, was facing cancellation. Instead of worrying about how the show's young protagonist, John Boy, would overcome adversity, American viewers were now far more interested in who'd shot J.R., the wealthy lead character of a new series, Dallas. Other family dramas about the rich and dysfunctional soon followed: Dynasty, Falcon Crest, The Colbys. Situation comedies dealing with topical or working-class issues, like MASH, Maude, Sanford and Son, All in the Family, were relics of a different era. In Hollywood, the year 1980 marked the end of the highly personal, director-driven filmmaking of the previous decade. Aside from Martin Scorsese's Raging Bull and Robert Redford's Ordinary People, due to open on September 19th, the most notable movies were big-budget comedies, action pictures, and sequels like Smokey and the Bandit 2. The popular music of a historical moment can be more memorable and evocative than its books, politics, or films. A number of songs released in 1980 had the ability to worm their way into your brain and resist all attempts to dislodge them. "Do That to Me One More Time" by Captain and Tennille, "You May Be Right" by Billy Joel, "Sailing" and "Ride Like the Wind" by Christopher Cross. Disco was finally dead, its fate sealed by the closing of the nightclub Studio 54 and the opening of Can't Stop the Music, a movie starring the Village People. Punk was dead too, and taking its place was the lighter, dance-oriented new wave of Devo, The Police, the B-52s, and Talking Heads. The hard rock of the Rolling Stones had given way to the softer pop sounds of Emotional Rescue. Led Zeppelin broke up, transforming Van Halen into America's favorite heavy metal band. Turning the radio dial on almost every FM station, you could hear Rough Edges becoming smooth. Outlaw country no longer threatened the Nashville establishment. It had fully entered the mainstream, with Willie Nelson's hit On the Road Again and Waylon Jennings's theme from The Dukes of Hazzard. Bob Dylan now refused to sing any of his old songs. Born Again and On the Road, he played only gospel. John Lennon was in New York City, recording a new album for the first time in years and looking forward in a few weeks to his 40th birthday. "Life begins at 40," Lennon told an interviewer. "It's like, wow, what's going to happen next?" In retrospect, it's easy to say that a particular year marked a turning point in history. And yet sometimes the significance of contemporary events is grasped, even in the moment. The United States of the 1960s and the 1970s, with its liberalism and countercultural turmoil, was about to become something different. The year 1980, the start of a new decade, was when that change became palpable, in ways both trivial and telling. During the first week of September, the anti-war activist and radical Abby Hoffman surrendered to federal authorities after more than 6 years on the run. Before turning himself in, Hoffman sat for a primetime television interview with Barbara Walters. Another radical leader, Jerry Rubin, had recently chosen a different path. In 1967, Hoffman and Rubin had tossed dollar bills over the balcony at the New York Stock Exchange as a protest against the evils of capitalism. In 1980, Rubin took a job as an investment analyst on Wall Street. "Politics and rebellion distinguished the 60s," he explained in the New York Times. "Money and financial interest will capture the passion of the 80s. Rubin had once again spotted a cultural shift and tried to place himself at its cutting edge. At the time, the highest paid banker in the United States was Roger E. Anderson, the head of Continental Illinois National Bank, who earned about $710,000 a year. The incomes on Wall Street would soon rise. Suits and ties were back in fashion. Mustaches, beards, and bell-bottoms had become uncool, and an ironic guide to the new zeitgeist, the official preppy handbook, was just arriving in stores. During a speech at the Republican convention that summer, Congressman Jack Kemp had noted what others did not yet acknowledge or see. "There is a tidal wave coming. A political tidal wave as powerful as the one that hit in 1932, when an era of Republican dominance gave way to the New Deal." No loan zones. At the pre-departure briefing, Childers and his crew learned that major maintenance was scheduled at Launch Complex 374-5 that day. The missile was being taken off alert so that the re-entry vehicle containing its warhead could be replaced. For an instructor crew, major maintenance was a waste of time. Lieutenant Serrano was training to become a deputy missile combat crew commander, and he needed to practice routine tasks in a control center. Captain Mazzaro found a commander who would switch complexes. Instead of 4-5, the instructor crew would go to 4-7, outside Damascus. The change of plans solved the training issue, but delayed the departure of both crews. Entry codes had to be swapped, duty orders rewritten and authenticated. The only important difference between the two launch complexes was their distance from Little Rock Air Force Base. 4-7 was a lot farther away, which meant Childers and his crew probably wouldn't be getting home until noon the next day. Mazzaro, Childers, Holder, Fuller, and Serrano tossed their bags into the back of an Air Force blue Chevy Suburban, climbed into it, and began the hour-long drive to Damascus. Within a mile, the Suburban's alternator light came on. So they had to turn around, go back to the base, find a new vehicle, move their gear, and fill out paperwork before leaving again. The day was not getting off to a smooth start. The 18 Titan II missile complexes in Arkansas were scattered throughout an area extending about 60 miles north of Little Rock Air Force Base and about 30 miles to the east and west. The missiles were dispersed roughly 7 to 10 miles from each other so that in the event of a surprise attack, One Soviet warhead couldn't destroy more than one Titan II silo. In the American West, ICBMs were usually set amid a vast, empty landscape, far from populated areas. In central Arkansas, the Titan II complexes were buried off backcountry roads, near small farms and little towns with names like Velvet Ridge, Mountain Home, Wonder View, and Old Texas. It was an unlikely setting for some of the most powerful nuclear weapons in the American arsenal. The decision to put ICBMs in rural Arkansas had been influenced by political as well as military considerations. One of the state's congressmen, Wilbur D. Mills, happened to be chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee when Titan II sites were being chosen. To reach Launch Complex 374-7, the crew drove west through the towns of Hamlet and Valonia, then north on Highway 65, a two-lane road that climbed into the foothills of the Ozark Mountains. Slavery had never reached this part of Arkansas, and the people who lived there were overwhelmingly poor, white, hard-working, and self-sufficient. It was the kind of poverty that carried little shame because everyone seemed to be in the same boat. The local farms were usually 30 to 40 acres in size and owned by the same families for generations. Farmers ran cattle, owned a few pigs, grew vegetables in the backyard. They were patriotic and rarely complained about the missiles in the neighborhood. Most of the income generated by the 308th was spent in the area around Little Rock. Aside from the occasional purchase of coffee and donuts, the missile crews passing through these rural communities added little to the local economy. For the most part, the airmen were treated warmly or hardly noticed. Despite the poverty, the feel of the place was bucolic. In early fall, the fields were deep green, dotted with round bales of hay, and the leaves on the trees, the black gums, sweet gums, maples, and oaks, were beginning to turn. The population of Damascus was about 400. The town consisted of a gas station, a small grocery store, and not much else. A few miles north along Highway 65, right after an old white farmhouse with a rusted tin roof, the combat crew turned left onto a narrow paved road, crossed a cattle guard, and drove half a mile. The launch complex was hidden from view until the road reached the crest of a low hill, and then there it was, a flat, square, 3-acre patch of land covered in gravel and ringed in chain link with the massive silo door in the middle, a couple of paved, rectangular parking areas on either side of it, half a dozen antennae rising from the ground, and a tall wooden pole that had three status lights mounted on top of it, one green, one yellow, one red, and a klaxon. The green said that all was clear, the yellow warned of a potential hazard, and the red light meant trouble. It rotated like the red lights on an old-fashioned highway patrol car, and accompanied by the loud blare of the klaxon, warned that there was an emergency on the site, or that the missile was about to take off. The launch complex didn't look like a high-security military outpost. The gray concrete silo door could have passed, to the untrained eye, as the cover of a municipal wastewater treatment plant. The sign on the entry gate spelled it out. "Warning," it said, in red capital letters, followed by these words in capital blue. "U.S. Air Force installation. It is unlawful to enter this area without permission of the installation commander." The barbed wire atop the chain-link fence discouraged a casual stroll onto the property, as did the triangular ANTPS-39 radar units. Mounted on short metal poles and nicknamed Tipsies, they detected the slightest motion near the silo door or the air intake shaft and set off an alarm. Captain Mazzaro got out of the truck, picked up the phone at the gate, and notified the control center of their arrival. The gate was unlocked by the crew underground, and Mazzaro walked across the complex to the access portal, a 16-foot square slab of concrete raised about a foot off the ground. Two steel doors lay flat on the slab. Beneath one was an elevator, below the other a stairway. Mazzaro opened the door on the left, climbed down a flight of concrete stairs, and waited a moment to be buzzed through another steel door. After he passed through it, the door locked behind him. Mazzaro had entered the entrapment area, a metal stairway enclosed on one side by a wall and on the other by steel mesh that rose to the ceiling. It looked like he'd walked into a cage. At the bottom of the stairs was another locked door with a television camera above it. Mazzaro picked up the phone on the wall, called the control center again, pulled the code card from his pocket, and read the 6-letter code aloud. After being granted permission to enter, he took out some matches and set the code card on fire. Then he dropped the burning card into a red canister mounted on the steel mesh. The rest of the crew was allowed to enter the complex. They parked the Suburban, checked the site for any signs of weather damage or a propellant leak, headed down the access portal, waited a moment in the entrapment area, then were buzzed through the door at the bottom of the stairs. The crew descended 2 more flights and reached an enormous blast door at the bottom of the stairs, about 30 feet underground. The access portal and its metal stairway were not designed to survive a nuclear blast. Everything beyond this blast door was. The steel door was about 7 feet tall, 5 feet wide, and 1 foot thick. It weighed roughly 6,000 pounds. The pair of steel door jams that kept it in place weighed an additional 31,000 pounds. The blast door was operated hydraulically with an electric switch. When the door was locked, 4 large steel pins extended from it into the frame, creating a formidable airtight seal. When the door was unlocked, it could easily be swung open or shut by hand. The launch complex had 4 identical blast doors. For some reason, this first one, at the bottom of the access portal, was blast door 6. Mazzaro picked up a phone near the door and called the control center again. He pushed a button on the wall, someone in the control center pushed a button simultaneously, and the pins in the door retracted from the frame. The crew opened the huge door and stepped into the blast lock, a room about 11 feet long and 12 feet wide. It was a transitional space between the access portal and the rest of the underground complex. Blast door 6 was at one end, blast door 7 at the other. In order to protect the missile and the control center from an explosion, the doors had been wired so that both couldn't be open at the same time. Beyond blast door 7 was another blast lock, the junction. To the right of it, a long steel-lined tunnel, the cableway, led to the missile. To the left, a shorter tunnel led to the control center. These 2 corridors were blocked by opposing blast doors, numbers 8 and 9, that also couldn't be opened at the same time. Every Titan II launch complex had exactly the same layout. Access portal, blast lock, then another blast lock, missile down the corridor to the right, control center down the corridor to the left, blast doors at the most vulnerable entry points. Every complex had the same equipment, the same wiring, lighting, and design. Nevertheless, each had its quirks. Blast door 9 at one site might require frequent maintenance. The control center air conditioning might be temperamental at another. The typical crew was assigned to a single complex and pulled every alert there. Some crew members had spent 2 nights a week for 10 years or more within the same underground facility. But an instructor crew served at different sites, depending on their availability. Al Childers had gotten to know all of the Titan II complexes in Arkansas, and for the most part couldn't tell the difference between them. Sometimes he had to look at the map on the wall of the control center to remember where he was. One launch complex, however, stood apart from the rest. 373-4 was known as the Ghost Site. It was the first complex where Childers was stationed, and odd things seemed to happen there. Pumps that could be operated only by hand suddenly went on by themselves. Lights turned on and off for no reason. Childers didn't believe in the supernatural, and most officers laughed at the idea that the complex might be haunted. But some crew members thought that every now and then it felt pretty odd down there. Rodney Holder was once working in the silo at night with another crew member. The silo had a manually operated elevator that traveled from levels 2 to 8, and the men had left its door open. The bell in the elevator started to ring. It rang whenever the door was open and someone on another level needed the elevator. Holder couldn't think of anyone who might need a ride. He called the control center and learned that nobody else was in the silo. The bell kept ringing. Holder and his partner were spooked, quickly finished their work, and returned to the control center. Launch Complex 373-4 had been the site of the worst Titan II accident thus far. On August 9, 1965, the complex outside Searcy, Arkansas, was being modified to make it more likely to survive a nuclear strike. Construction crews were hardening the silo, improving the blast doors, adjusting the hydraulics, installing emergency lights. The re-entry vehicle and the warhead had been removed from the missile, serial number 62-0006, but its fuel tanks and oxidizer tanks were full. Four crew members manned the control center as scores of construction workers labored underground and topside on a hot summer afternoon. It was Gary Lay's first day on the job. He was 17 years old and had just graduated from high school in Searcy. His father had found him work at the complex. Lay was glad to have it. The money was good, and the temperature in the silo was a hell of a lot cooler than it was outdoors. Lay had been hired for the summer to do menial tasks and clean up after other workers. He'd never visited a missile complex before. His safety training consisted of watching You and the Titan II, a one-hour film. When it was over, Lay was handed a mask with a filter and told in case of emergency to use the elevator. He spent the morning at the bottom of the silo, quit for lunch around noon, and came back an hour later. At approximately 1 o'clock, Lay was standing in the underground cableway when someone asked him to grab a bucket and a mop from the silo. He walked down the corridor, which entered the silo at level 2. A few minutes later, he was talking to a group of workers in the level 2 equipment area, not far from the emergency escape ladder. Men were busy in all 9 levels of the silo, some of them painting, others flushing the hydraulic system that raised and lowered the steel platforms beside the missile. Lay heard a big puff, like the sound of a gas stove being lit, and felt a warm breeze. Then he saw bright yellow flames rising from the floor to the ceiling. He ran to the escape ladder and tried to climb down, but the ladder was jammed with workers. Moments later, the lights went out. Black smoke filled the silo, and it soon felt like the darkest place on earth. Workers were shouting, panicking, desperately trying to find a way out. Lay somehow managed to get back to the level 2 equipment area. He blindly felt his way along the wall, fell down, got back up, and instinctively headed toward the origin of the fire, while others ran away from it. At about the same time that Lay heard the big puff and felt the heat, the fire diesel area light in the control center began to flash red. Klaxons sounded throughout the complex, and the revolving red status light on the outdoor pole lit up. Captain David A. Yount, the crew commander, told everyone to evacuate, giving the order 3 times over the public address system. And then the power went out. Pipe fitters who'd been working on the blast doors ran up the access portal stairway. Smoke pouring from a vent in the silo door told workers topside that something was wrong. A number of them tried to get down to the silo, but were driven back by thick clouds of smoke. Lay made it to the cableway, then to the control center, suffering from second and third degree burns. He was placed in a decontamination shower. While Lay was being rinsed off with cold water, 2 crew members, Sergeant Ronald O. Wallace and Airman First Class Donald E. Hastings, put on air packs, grabbed fire extinguishers, and prepared to enter the silo. Amid the commotion, they noticed that another worker, Hubert A. Saunders, was calmly sitting in the control center. Saunders had been painting at level 1A of the silo, near the top of the missile, when smoke started drifting toward him. The lights went out just as he reached a ladder, and he climbed 20 feet down in the pitch black. Saunders had worked at Titan II complexes for years and knew the layout. He held his breath while passing through the level 2 equipment area, then crawled on his hands and knees down the cableway. Aside from inhaling some smoke, he was fine, and he'd never let go of his paint can and brush. Wallace and Hastings rushed down the long, dark cableway to battle the fire and rescue survivors. The smoke was so dense that they could not see the floor. Saunders and Lay were escorted from the complex and taken by ambulance to the hospital in Searcy, where preparations were hastily being made to treat dozens of injured workers. Hours passed, but none arrived. The flash fire in the equipment area on level 2 had filled the silo with smoke, then sucked the oxygen out. The exit to the cableway from level 2 offered the only possibility of escape. Some workers had mistakenly climbed down the ladder toward the bottom of the silo. Others were blocked trying to climb up. One was trapped in the elevator when the power went out. Workers weren't killed by the flames. They were asphyxiated by the smoke. Of the 55 men who'd returned to the silo after lunch, only Saunders and Lay left there alive. Helicopters brought firemen from Little Rock Air Force Base to 373-4, but their work was hampered by the poor visibility. They managed to extinguish a few small fires on level 2, but fire was no longer the real danger. Without power, the site lacked air conditioning, and as the temperature in the silo rose, so did the pressure in the missile's oxidizer tanks. Nitrogen tetroxide expanded in the heat. Its boiling point was only 70 degrees Fahrenheit. By 5 o'clock that evening, the temperature in the silo was 78 degrees and rising. Opening the silo door would help cool the missile and vent the smoke, but the door couldn't be opened without electrical power. Smoke had seeped into the control center as well, complicating efforts to manage the crisis. All 4 blast doors had been propped open so workers could freely move within the complex. The pins on blast door 8 at the entrance to the control center had deliberately been left extended so the door wouldn't shut. And without power, the pins couldn't be retracted. At 7 o'clock, SAC headquarters in Omaha warned that if the temperature in the silo wasn't reduced, the missile's Stage 2 oxidizer tank was likely to reach an explosive situation around midnight. Firemen and PTS teams worked in the hot, smoke-filled complex to recover bodies, restore power, and prevent an explosion. At 10 o'clock, the temperature in the silo reached 80 degrees, then started to fall. Portable lighting units, generators, and industrial air conditioners were hooked up, and by early morning, an even greater disaster had been averted. The 53rd body was carried from the silo at daybreak. An Air Force Accident Investigation Board later concluded that a worker who'd been welding on level 2 inadvertently struck a temporary hydraulics line. When the spray of hydraulic fluid hit the arc of the electric welder, it caught fire. The Air Force attributed the accident to human error. But Gary Lay insisted that nobody had been welding on level 2 and that a mechanical fault had started the fire. He thought that a hydraulics line must have ruptured, spraying flammable oil onto electrical equipment. The missile in the silo wasn't damaged, and the equipment areas were repaired. About 1 year after the accident, launch crews were back at the complex near Searcy to pull alerts. It looked just like any other complex, except for a few blackened walls in the silo that someone had forgotten to paint. Childers and his crew passed through blast door 8, walked down the short cableway, and entered the launch control center. The room was round and about 35 feet in diameter. It was on the second level of a 3-story steel structure, suspended on enormous springs within a buried concrete cylinder. The walls were 2 feet thick. The ceiling was covered with a maze of ducts and pipes. The color scheme was a mix of pale turquoise, light gray, the dull silver of unpainted steel. The room had the strong, confident vibe of Eisenhower-era science and technology. It was full of intricately wired machinery and electronics, but did not have a computer. To the right stood a series of steel cabinets that displayed the status and housed the controls of the guidance system, the power and electrical systems, the topside alarm. The cabinets were about 7 feet tall and covered with all sorts of switches, gauges, dials, and small round lights. In the center of the room was the commander's console, a small steel desk, turquoise and gray, with rows of square buttons and warning lights. It monitored and controlled the most important functions of the complex. The commander could open the front gate from there, change the warhead's target, enable or abort a launch. In the middle of the console was the launch switch. It was unmarked, blocked by a security seal, and activated by a key. On top of the console was a digital gauge that showed the pressure in the missile's fuel and oxidizer tanks. Two small speakers were bolted to the side of the desk. Throughout the day, they broadcast test messages from SAC headquarters and, during wartime, would give the order to launch. To the left of the commander's console was another small turquoise and gray desk where the deputy commander sat. He had operated the site's communication systems. Directly above the desk was a large round clock with numbers from 00 through 23 on the face and a thick black casing. The clock was set to Greenwich Mean Time, so launches at the Titan II sites in Arkansas, Kansas, and Arizona could be synchronized. The deputy commander's launch switch was on the upper left side of the desk. It was round, silver, unmarked, and resembled the ignition switch of an old car. The launch codes and keys were kept in a bright red safe with two brass combination locks, one belonging to the commander, the other to the deputy. It was nicknamed the Go-to-War safe. If a launch order came over the speakers, the officers were supposed to unlock their locks, open the safe, grab their codes and keys, then return to their consoles. The keys looked unexceptional, like the kind used to unlock millions of American front doors. The codes were hidden inside flat plastic disks called cookies. The disks were broken open by hand, like fortune cookies, and the codes were read aloud. And if the codes authenticated the emergency war order from SAC headquarters, the launch checklist went something like this. Surface warning control, lighted red. Remove security seals and insert keys into switches. Launch keys, inserted. Circuit breaker 103 on, set. BVLC operate code word, entered. Simultaneously, within 2 seconds, turn keys for 5 seconds or until sequence starts. Launch enable, lighted. Batteries activated, lighted. APS power, lighted. Silo soft, lighted. Guidance go, lighted. Fire engine, lighted. Liftoff, lighted. Assuming that everything worked as planned, the Titan II would be gone within seconds. Its warhead would strike the target in about half an hour. Once the missile left the silo, the crew's job was done. They couldn't destroy a missile mid-flight or launch another. The complex was designed to be used once. The Titan II would not launch, however, unless the two keys were turned at the same time. The launch switches were too far apart for one person to activate them both. SAC's two-man policy had been adopted to prevent a deranged or fanatic crew member from starting a nuclear war. The butterfly valve lock on the Stage 1 rocket engine offered some additional control over who could launch the missile. Oxidizer wouldn't flow into that engine until the correct butterfly valve lock code, BVLC, was used during the launch checklist. And without the oxidizer, the missile would stay in the silo. This code wasn't kept in the safe or anywhere else on the complex. It was transmitted with the emergency war order from SAC. and the valve lock contained a small explosive device. Any attempt to tamper with the lock set off the explosive and sealed the oxidizer line shut. The SAC two-man rule governed not only how the missile was launched, but also how the complex was run. At least two authorized personnel always had to be present and within visual range of each other in the control center. You couldn't allow the other person out of your sight. The same rule applied in the silo whenever the missile had a warhead. At entrances to the control center and the silo, a warning stenciled in bold red letters said, "No lone zone. SAC two-man policy mandatory." The commander and the deputy commander at every Titan II site were issued .38 caliber revolvers, in case an intruder penetrated the underground complex or a crew member disobeyed orders. Transferring the weapons was part of the turnover checklist when a new crew arrived for duty. In addition to the handguns and their holsters, Mazzaro and Childers received some bad news from the crew preparing to leave 4-7. Pressure in the Stage 2 oxidizer tank was low. A PTS team would have to visit the site, and most of the day would have to be devoted to major maintenance. Before the other crew departed, Mazzaro and Childers opened the safe, made sure the cookies and launch keys were inside, shut it, and installed their own locks. For the next hour or so, Mazzaro, Childers, Holder, and Fuller went through the daily shift verification, DSV checklist in the control center. They checked every piece of equipment on all three levels of the center, every gauge, switch, and warning light. Level 3 was the basement. It housed the DC power supplies and battery backups, switching equipment for the communications systems, the air conditioning and ventilation systems. Fresh air was pulled into the control center from outdoors, filtered, cooled, and then sent throughout the rest of the complex. The positive airflow helped to protect the crew from toxic vapors that might drift from the silo. The go-to-war safe, the tall steel cabinets, and the launch consoles were on level 2. The top floor, level 1, had a kitchen, a small round table, 4 chairs, a toilet, and 4 beds. The complex had enough food to last for a month, but its emergency diesel generator had enough fuel for only 2 weeks. During wartime, the crew might find itself eating canned and dehydrated military rations in the dark. PTS Team A was scheduled to pressurize the Stage 2 oxidizer tank at the complex. The 8-man team was led by Senior Airman Charles T. Heineman, who would direct its work from the control center. Airman David W. Adderhold, Eric Ayala, and Richard D. Willinghurst would remain topside to operate the nitrogen tank. Adderhold and Ayala would be in REFCO suits. Airmen Roger A. Hamm and Gregory W. Lester would stay in the blast lock as backup to the men working in the silo, ready to put on their REFCOs in an emergency. And Airmen David Powell and Jeffrey Plum would enter the silo in REFCOs, remove the pressure cap, and attach the nitrogen line. Powell and Plum hoped to get started on the missile early in the afternoon, but the work platforms wouldn't descend from the silo walls. They were stuck in the upright position. A repair crew was working on them. Something was wrong with the hydraulic system, and troubleshooting with help from the tech manuals couldn't fix it. The hassles continued to mount. The hydropneumatic accumulator was broken, and without it, the platforms couldn't be lowered. And the repair crew didn't have the right parts. If pressure in the Stage 2 oxidizer tank dropped any further, the missile would have to be taken off alert. SAC headquarters was never pleased when a missile went off alert, and so a helicopter was sent from Little Rock Air Force Base with the parts. Meanwhile, Rodney Holder and Ron Fuller continued to go through the daily shift verification checklist, walking down the long corridor to the silo. The cableway was essentially a big steel pipe, braced with girders and springs, that stretched almost 50 yards from the blast lock to the silo. The floor was painted gray, the walls and ceilings turquoise. Bundles of pipes and cables snaked overhead and along both sides. It looked like the interior of a submarine that was somehow underground, not underwater. The silo's 9 levels were crammed with equipment, and the checklist there took about 2 hours to complete. It had hundreds of steps. Sometimes crews would cut corners to speed things up. They'd divide the labor. You check this air compressor, I'll check that one, and violate the SAC 2-man rule, roaming separately through the silo and comparing notes later. It was faster that way. The violation seemed trivial, and officers in the control center had no way of knowing what the enlisted men were doing in the silo. The television camera in the access portal, aimed at the entrapment area, was the only one in the complex. From the control center, you couldn't see what was happening in the cableways, the blast lock, the silo, or topside. There was no periscope. And one officer could not leave the other alone in the control center to check on what crew members were doing elsewhere. That would be a serious violation of the 2-man rule. Holder and Fuller did everything by the book that day. As members of an instructor crew, they took pride in being considered among the best at the job. A standardization evaluation team was soon going to be judging their work, and Holder wanted a high score. Doing things properly added only 15 minutes or so to the job. Before joining the Air Force, he'd been a construction worker, building highway bridges in rural Arkansas. A career in the military hadn't appealed to him at first. His father was a former NFL player who joined the Naval Reserve during the Korean War and wound up spending more than 2 decades as a naval officer. Holder had attended grade schools in 3 different countries and high schools in 4 different states. At the age of 19, he liked doing construction work but worried about the future. The military promised a more interesting and rewarding life. Joining the Navy wasn't an option. Holder got seasick too easily. So he joined the Air Force, eager to learn about missiles. Working on the Titan II had revealed that, deep down, he was a techno-geek. Holder knew his way around the complex better than any of the other crew members. He not only knew what everything was, he could explain how it worked. On September 18, 1980, he was 24 years old and had been married for 10 months. The silo door motors on level 1A had to be checked, as did the sump at the bottom of level 9B, and everything in between. The equipment areas of the silo tended to be loud, but the launch duct was lined with sound dampeners so that the roar of the engines wouldn't cause vibrations and damage the missile. It was so quiet in the launch duct that on hot summer days, when the air conditioners were struggling, warm oxidizer could be heard bubbling in the tanks. The only problem that Holder and Fuller noted that day was a faulty switch on the hard water tank. The complex had 2 large water tanks, one inside the silo, extending from levels 3 to 6, and one topside beyond the perimeter fence. The tank within the silo was considered hard because it was underground and therefore shielded from a nuclear blast. It held 100,000 gallons of water that would spray into the silo moments before launch. The water helped to suppress the sound of the engines and ensured that flames wouldn't rise up the silo and destroy the missile. The 2 water tanks were also essential for extinguishing a major fire at the complex. Like a broken float in a toilet that allows only 1 flush, a faulty gauge on the hard water tank could prevent it from refilling automatically. Holder and Fuller noted the problem on the checklist and moved to the next step. PTS Team A reached the complex around 3:30 in the afternoon, but the platforms still wouldn't lower. Having nothing better to do, the team hung out and played cards around the table in level 1 of the control center. Jeffrey Plum, who was new to the group, lay on one of the beds. They'd been working since early in the morning and were ready to be finished with the day. PTS teams and launch crews didn't tend to socialize. The PTS guys were a different breed. Outside of work, they had a reputation for being rowdy and wild. They had one of the most dangerous jobs in the Air Force, and at the end of the day they liked to blow off steam, drinking and partying harder than just about anyone else at the base. They were more likely to ride motorcycles, ignore speed limits, violate curfews, and toss a commanding officer into a shower fully clothed after consuming too much alcohol. They called the missiles birds, and they were attached to them and proud of them in the same way that good automobile mechanics care about cars. The danger of the oxidizer and the fuel wasn't theoretical. It was part of the job. The daily risks often inspired a defiant cavalier attitude among the PTS guys. Some of them had been known to fill a ping-pong ball with oxidizer and toss it into a bucket of fuel. The destruction of the steel bucket, accompanied by flames, was a good reminder of what they were working with. And if you were afraid of the propellants, as most people would be, you needed to find a different line of work. Although low pressure in an oxidizer tank could mean a leak, PTS Team A wasn't worried about it. This was the third day in a row that they'd been called out to 4-7. The missile in the silo had recently been recycled. The warhead and the propellants were removed during a recycle, and then the missile was lifted from the silo, hauled back to the base, carefully checked for corrosion and leaks. Later, the same missile might be returned to the complex, or a different one might be shipped there from storage. The fuel and oxidizer pressure often didn't stabilize at the proper levels for weeks after a recycle. PTS teams were accustomed to adding more nitrogen, 2, 3, 4 times until the tank pressures settled. At the conclusion of the recycle at 4-7, a Titan II was placed in the silo, filled with propellants and armed with a warhead. The missile's serial number was 62-0006, the same missile that had been in the silo during the fire at the complex near Circe, now stood on the thrust mount at Launch Complex 374-7 north of Damascus. The odds were slim that the same Titan II airframe, out of dozens, would wind up in those two places. Bad luck, fate, sheer coincidence? Whatever the explanation, neither the launch crew nor the PTS team knew that this missile had once been in a silo full of thick smoke and dying men. By 6 o'clock in the evening, the platforms had finally been repaired, and the PTS team was ready to do its work. Childers was in the control center instructing the trainee. Mazzaro and Heinemann, the PTS team chief, were there as well, going over the checklist for the procedure. Holder decided to get a few hours of sleep. Although the control center was underground and far removed from the world, it was always noisy. Motors, fans, and pumps were constantly switching on and off. Test messages from SAC were loudly broadcast over the speakers, and telephones rang. The sound had nowhere to go, so it bounced off the walls. Holder never slept well there, even with earplugs. The vibration bothered him more than the noise. The whole place was mounted on springs, and there was so much machinery running that the walls and the floors always seemed to be vibrating. It was the sort of thing you didn't notice until you became perfectly still, and then it became hard to ignore. Holder took off his socks and shoes, put on a t-shirt and some pants from an old uniform, and had a bite to eat before bed. He was washing dishes when the klaxon went off. The sound was excruciatingly loud, like a fire alarm, an electric buzzer inside your head. He didn't think much of it. Whenever a nitrogen line was connected to an oxidizer tank, a little bit of vapor escaped. The vapor detectors in the silo were extremely sensitive, and they'd set off the klaxon. It happened almost every time a PTS team did this procedure. The launch crew would reset the alarm, and the klaxon would stop. It was no big deal. Holder kept doing the dishes. The klaxon stopped. And then 10 or 15 seconds later, it started blaring again. Dang, Holder thought. Why'd that go off again? He heard people scurrying on the level below and wondered what was going on. He went halfway down the stairs, looked at the commander's console, and saw all sorts of lights flashing. He thought the PTS team must have spiked the MSA. the vapor detector manufactured by the Mine Safety Appliances Company. If the MSA became saturated with too much vapor, it spiked, going haywire and setting off numerous alarms. That didn't mean anything was wrong, but it did mean one more hassle. Now the crew would have to conduct a formal investigation with portable vapor detectors. Holder went back upstairs and grabbed his boots. When he came down again, Captain Mazzaro was standing and talking on the phone to the command post in Little Rock. Childers was giving orders to the PTS team topside. Something wasn't right. Holder sat at the commander's console and looked down at rows of red warning lights. Oxy-vapor launch duct was lit. Fuel-vapor launch duct was lit. Vapor silo equip area, vapor oxy pump room, and vapor fuel pump room were lit. He'd seen those before when an MSA spiked, but he'd never seen two other lights flashing red. Fire fuel pump room and fire launch duct. Those were serious. There's a problem, Holder thought, and it could be a big one. Spheres within spheres. In the old black-and-white photograph, a young man stands at the bedroom door of a modest home. He wears khakis and a white t-shirt, carries a small metal box, and doesn't smile for the camera. He could be a carpenter arriving for work with his lunch or his tools in the box. A cowboy hat hangs on the wall, and a message has been scrawled on the door in white chalk. Please use other door. Keep this room clean. The photo was taken on the evening of July 12, 1945, at the McDonald Ranch House near Carrizozo, New Mexico. Sergeant Herbert M. Lair had just arrived with the unassembled plutonium core of the world's first nuclear device. The house belonged to a local rancher, George McDonald, until the Army obtained it in 1942, along with about 50,000 acres of land, and created the Alamogordo Bombing and Gunnery Range. The plutonium core spent the night at the house, guarded by security officers. A team of physicists from the Manhattan Project was due at 9 o'clock the next morning, Friday the 13th. After billions of federal dollars spent on this top-secret project, after the recruitment of Nobel laureate